Okay. Now, I'm sure our guest this evening is known to 95% of people in the room. A portion of one person might know who he, might not know who he is. I will nonetheless introduce him. Dr. Matthew Feldman is Reader in Contemporary History at the School of Arts and Media, Teesside University. The two wings, occasionally united, of his research are fascist ideology in the contemporary far right and the literary history of modernism, especially Samuel Beckett and Edward Hand. His breakthrough work in our context was, of course, Beckett's books in 2006, I think. But he's also published so many articles and book chapters, I'm sure you've read, on different aspects of Beckett's work. He's currently editing, along with David here, a critical edition of Beckett's Philosophy Notes. And if they're as useful as the Beckett's books was, then that'll be a treat. His most recent monograph, however, was published last year, as Ezra Pound's Fascist Propaganda, 1935-45. He's also one of the editors of the Historicising Modernism series of Bloomsbury, and last but not least, he's one of the founders of this series, so it's very nice to have him back in last year. His title this evening is Beckett's Late Style and the Influence of Radio Adaptations.
Thank you, Peter, and David, for having me along. It's 10, isn't it? We've been going for 10 years, and that's really a testament to David and Peter having it for the last several years of running it so successfully with the Swanky website. I should also thank, just at the outset, Connor Carville, who swapped with me at pretty late notice, which was extremely generous of him, but I'm in a Marx meeting pretty much every day, it seems like, but also on the 17th. So thanks to all three of you. Just a couple of points for your attention, maybe, before we get started and look at some of the materials. I was going to talk a little bit more about Beckett's late style, but we'll have to probably leave that for discussion. This is going to really kind of intend to talk about some of the materials of the BBC Written Archive Centre, which was the subject of a book that some of us put together, that like half the contributors are in here. Henry had one on Orwell, Finn on Joyce, David on Orwell, Peter on E.M. Forster. So there's, and much of that material really deriving from the Written Archive Center. So I'll talk about that in a moment. But I also know that Peter mentioned this last week, and it bears mentioning here that Julie Campbell, the great Beckettian and wonderful person, passed away a couple of weeks back, and she really had gone further in the 21st century in looking at this material and thinking about how it relates to Beckett's poetics. So, not just because she is a dear friend who will very, very much be missed, but also because she had inspired so much of this work that what I have to say is at the very least in memory of her. She was the first one really to publish on the material at Caversham, and her article in the current issue of Samuel Beckett Today, Aujourd'hui, is really just a remarkable piece of work, as I'll mention today, called Beckett in the Third Program, really bears looking at. She talks about these collections of files on Beckett and notes, and I would certainly agree that they, for too long, have remained dusty, not just on Beckett, on a number of other authors that that may come up. But given the genuine treasures, of which I'll just be showing some images of these BBC Written Archive Centre, this paper is going to broadly be considered Beckett's relationship with BBC Radio from about the mid-1950s on, and broach the question at the end of its influence upon his later works. And just by way of passing, some of those works are actually circling around. There's three small texts. The Drunken Boat, which was a piece that Beckett translated and has a long introduction by James Knowlson. The first publication of a text called For to End Yet Again, and in addition of Waiting for Godot. So if you can just circulate those. Now, just to kind of contextualize some of these materials, they cover a range of areas concerning Beckett's work for the BBC, including contracting, correspondence, negotiation over content, and much more, revealing collectively a far greater engagement with British radio broadcasting than has been previously acknowledged. Many Beckett scholars have written about the crucial years between 1957 and 62, which included his oft-discussed canonical radio plays, those works written directly and specifically for radio. That's All That Fall, Embers, Words of Music, Cascando, Rough for Radio 1, and Rough for Radio 2. Also sometimes included is his translation of Robert Penge's La Manivelle, the old tune. So all of those were specifically done for the BBC between 57 and 62. Yet Beckett's radio work also extended to adaptations for most of his prose, including Walk, the Trilogy, and many of his shorter texts, as well as many dramatic works from Endgame in French to play, and even that copy of Godot there, which includes a narrator. This is the material as they give it to you in the Written Archive Center. It is emphatically non-digital, so you start out with 3x5 cards there. All of this is reflected in the files I'm going to discuss today, alongside discussions over musical accompaniment, payment negotiations, unauthorized BBC cuts, the framing by the institution, and much more. So following a broad overview of these materials, my focus will then be turned towards several themes that may be said to contribute to a change in Beckett's late poetics and writing. And I suppose the question that might be worth, especially the more literary-minded in this room, kind of thinking to yourself is, how does this impact upon Beckett's late prose? Is it true that there is more of an emphasis on the oral voice, a depersonalization? And maybe those are things that we can discuss at the end. But first of all, as numerous scholars have made clear, the reception of En Attendant Godot saw Beckett's reputation as an artist take off. Early to recognize this was Donald McWhinney, who was soon to become one of Beckett's most trusted collaborators. McWhinney had already received the French play in 1953 with an eye to inclusion in the BBC's third program on the 24th of March, that is, less than 3 months after its premiere at the Théâtre de Babylone in Paris. Considering running Godot in French within 2-3 months of its Paris premiere thus clearly underscores Jeff Porta's recent contention that the third program launched in September 1946 to air the BBC's most highbrow Reithian output, quote, pushed for new, abstract, and experimental works from the start. Yet this very ambition posed constraints, as the first controller of the third program, Harman Griswood, lamented as early as 1949. He says, quote, our experience today has shown that we cannot expect a very substantial flow of worthwhile contemporary radio drama at third program level. We will be lucky if during the year we can find, say, 10 pieces which are suitable. For the rest, we must decide what to perform from the corpus of dramatic literature which is written for theater. Now, according to Porter, quote, this outlook, this view changed dramatically with the appointment of McWhinney as the BBC's assistant head of drama for sound, who would lead the third program in an aggressive search for original material. So right now, just at the start, the central points to take away from the introductory backdrop are twofold. One, the third program was most unapologetically highbrow and, quote, made no concessions to popular taste in the view of the new third program controller, John Morris. But secondly, and perhaps more relevantly here, BBC staff correspondingly saw in Waiting for Godot, albeit not without internal dissent, what they called a, quote, basically radiogenic work, one suitable for translation and immediate adaptation for BBC radio, since the play would be, quote, entirely novel to an English audience in nearly every respect. In fact, the BBC had actually received Beckett's completed translation at the end of September 1953, though the project took a mortal blow when McWhinney's line manager, the head of drama sound, Val Gilgood, adjudged on the 20th of September, only a month after receiving it, that there was something ultimately phony about the play. As a result, the idea was shelved until early 1954, when 18 months later, the enterprising BBC producer and director who was quoted above, Raymond Raikes, informed Gilgood upon seeing the Peter Hall production of Godot staged in London, On Your Instructions, that it would be, quote, culpably unenterprising. There we go. Culpably unenterprising not to undertake this project. Raikes concluded in no uncertain terms, as you can see there, may I suggest that we record and broadcast this production as soon as possible, lest it be said that the BBC has once again missed the boat, that being a minor tragedy that it hadn't been aired already in April 1953. In the event the play needed to complete its London run first, in fact, broadcasting it within 12 months of its West End finale apparently needed Peter Hall's personal consent, even if there was no doubt that during this time the BBC continued wooing Beckett. Those words, that characterization is from Julie Campbell's landmark text I mentioned in SBTA 25, really the first proper engagement with BBC Written Archive Center Holdings since Klaus Iliakis's 1976 monograph and a dozen years later Rosemary Pouty's unjustly neglected Theatre of Shadows. Yet these texts too, like the present survey, really only scratch the surface of Beckett's engagement with the third program, and from the 30th of September 1967, Radio 3. These are just a couple of examples, as you can see, really covering that crucial period, 1957 to 62, when we see a huge, a very intense bout of creativity, Beckett working with the BBC. As the most recently published volume of Beckett's selected letters makes clear, on the 8th of August 1955, that is, immediately following the opening of Sir Peter Hall's Waiting for Godot at the London Court Theatre, a Royal Court Theatre in London, the dramatic agent Margaret Ramsay suggested a reading of extracts from the Merlin Press's limited edition of Watt, at that time only published in a limited edition in Paris. Thus, for his first foray in radio, Beckett received 25,000 francs for Jack Holmstrom's reading on the 7th of September as an interlude of prose, that reading from Watt, for the third program. So it wasn't Godot, it was in fact Watt that was the first text that sort of got Beckett stuck into the BBC. This pretty swiftly led to a rather better-known work, namely All That Fall, a 70-minute radio play written specifically for the third program, which in Paul Stewart's recent judgment is about sexual reproduction being replaced by aesthetic regeneration as a means of creating out of nothing. I think Stewart's very important reading implies Beckett's turn to radio came at a particularly propitious time. He had recently concluded the so-called Siege in the Room, where Beckett had written Godot, the earlier play Eleutheria, as well as seven poems, the novella Mercier and Camier, but of course the trilogy Molloy, Malone Dies, and The Unnameable, in addition to fully 17 short stories, 13 of which collected as text for nothing, this huge bout of creativity. Despite these post-war masterpieces, though, it seems that by the mid-1950s, Beckett had written himself into something of a creative corner. This is amply testified by any one of a number of letters across these years, for example, to his old friend in Ireland, Thomas McGreevy, in September 1953. He says, quote, "I tell me, take art easy, but nothing will come anymore, all contracted and unhappy about it." Nearly a year later, 1954, to his American publisher at Grove Press, Barney Rossett, quote, "I think my writing days are over. The unnameable finished me or expressed my finishedness." As usual, James Knowlson's Damned to Fame remains the surest guide to Beckett's biographical context during these and pretty much any other years, and argues that this period led to what he calls in the chapter Impasse and Depression, 56 to 58. So that should be 58. And he says, Beckett's depression was slow to lift as he began to experience renewed doubt as to whether there was any way out of the impasse into which the unnameable, or probably more specifically, the translation of the unnameable into English and Endgame had led him. The medium of radio, with the challenge of its technical constraints, offered one possible escape route. And there you see this wonderful quote by Donald McWhinney, also in the BBC WAC files. "My impression is that if he is to write at all in the near future, it will be for radio, which has captured his imagination." That right after the first broadcast of All That Fall in early 1957. But going back a little bit, 6 months or so, the writing of All That Fall in summer 1956, to be sure, had really grasped Beckett's imagination. Although initially needing what John Morris called, quote, "a little more persuasion from the BBC," since he has never written anything for the radio before, the third program's controller, John Morris, was swiftly dispatched to Paris, where a fortnight later, he reported back to Gielgud. "As arranged, I saw Samuel Beckett in Paris this morning. He is extremely keen to write an original work for the third program and has indeed already done the first few pages of his script. We can expect something pretty good." All That Fall was swiftly completed and sent to Morris in London just over 2 months later. As Klaus Iliakis, Julie Campbell, and many others have noticed, this was something of a breakthrough all round. Even the previously nonplussed head of drama, the one who dismissed Godot as phony, was overwhelmed by the production, writing, as you can see here, to McWhinney the day after the 13 January 1957 broadcast of All That Fall, "My warmest congratulations on your outstanding success with the Beckett play." I'm not going to read it for you, but "well done" is really the long and short of his text, really commends him on how difficult the play was. So this is an internal memorandum, obviously suggesting the BBC was pleased with it. But the effect on Beckett was equally electric. As the traditional account goes, by no means wrongly, he went on to produce another 4 radio plays in as many years, or 5 if one counts Rough Radio 1, which was not broadcast in Beckett's lifetime. I think it was 2006 it received its first broadcast. Embers in 1959, Words of Music in 61, Cascando in 62, with both of the rest probably attempted, in the early 1960s, and Rough Radio 2 broadcast on the 13th of April 1976 in honor of Beckett's 70th birthday. Alongside Beckett's 1960 radio adaptation, The Old Tune, these well-known works were reissued by the British Library in 2006 as Samuel Beckett Works for Radio, and all have been ably discussed by Beckett scholars who, by and large, highlighted the pivotal nature of radiogenic writing at this point in Beckett's career. We shall have cause to consider this bigger picture the last 30 years or so, in closing, especially in terms of how interpretations of Beckett's later works maybe seem to have been affected by this embrace of radio. But with some fully 24 additional adaptations undertaken by the Third Program and Radio 3 during Beckett's lifetime, most of which remain unexamined, indeed unknown, by Beckett scholars, it is high time to fundamentally reevaluate the scope and significance of that work. And so to properly survey this material, I want to mix something of an overview of these materials with several overarching themes emerging from the files and kind of discussion in Beckett studies more generally. And I talk about adaptation, by that I mean broadcasted works not specifically written for radio. I understand that's going to be a very contentious term, but I'm thinking of the sort of everything but those canonical 5 texts written specifically for radio. Now the reason I should hold my hand up for this broad brush approach is pretty simple. For its some 2,000 pages of text and microfilm, this is, in my judgment, the largest untapped archive of Beckett materials remaining out there. To reformulate this proposition, in a Beckett country now so well plowed by 4 generations of scholars, this is about as fertile as it's going to get. So by way of invitation to fellow scholars, if nothing else, I want to move on to these insightful materials by way of 3 points, hopefully directly contributing to debates and scholarship in contemporary Beckett studies. Indeed, each of the following themes I'm going to address could be an article to itself. Censorship and textual variance, collaboration and creativity, contracts and money, and again a final concluding glance at Beckett's reception and some of its interpretative promise that it might hold out to scholars. Now, there are fascinating elements of the BBC WAC materials that I'm not even going to address. For example, the Third Program broadcast and first publication in English of For to End Yet Again, which is just there from the 4th of October 1976. That is, 3 weeks before it was available for purchase in Britain. Not sure if that's necessarily for publication, but that's what the BBC called it. Or again, with respect to discussions over Beckett's bilingualism, there's the insightful Martin Esslin production 6 months later of Arthur Rimbaud's The Drunken Boat, based on Beckett's 1930s translation, as explained in James Nolson's extensive introduction to this broadcast of the 12th of March, 1977. Do you mind if we just pass those around? So we've got The Drunken Boat, Godot, and For to End Yet Again. Just a couple of examples of these texts that have been really just kind of sitting on microfilm at the BBC Written Archives Centre. Indeed, the BBC's framing and prefaces to Beckett's work is another subject worthy of critical attention. Quite apart from these adaptations of Beckett's work, moreover, there are plenty of previously unseen discussions on Beckett's work, like the 32-minute New Comment program devoted entirely to Beckett's art, featuring broadcast interviews with Barbara Bray, Martin Esslin, and Patrick McGee on the 11th of August, 1961, which I can't bloody seem to manage to turn up my copy of it, but that's another, it's another matter. So anyway, with some of these highlights or themes in mind, it's now time for situating some of these materials in rather less haphazard fashion. Here's one nice little example. People have talked a lot about the fact that Beckett was unwilling to have his work transferred from one medium to another. I think the start of where some of this was is this wonderful line here, where he basically just got really wound up with the BBC's TV production of Kraft's Last Tape. And you can see there, this is to copyright from his agents, who probably realize that they stand to lose a fair amount of money. And they comment there that he's refused to let other works be adapted. And he said, and they say at the end there, oh dear. So anyway, so the first theme, censorship and textual variance. As is well known, Beckett was a meticulous artist, one loath to make concessions to censors, popular morality, or editors of any stripe.
In the second half of the 1950s alone, for instance, Nolson reports that Beckett withdrew from the Dublin International Festival due to the organizers' boycott of Joyce and O'Casey's work, and ceased allowing his own work to be performed in Ireland for some years thereafter. Still more famously, most of us will know the story of the Lord Chamberlain's office objecting to the so-called prayer scene in the English language Endgame, ordering 21 lines to be cut or bowdlerized before granting a license to perform at the Royal Court Theatre. Changing the line, quote, "God the bastard, he doesn't exist," was simply a step too far for Beckett, who wrote to his director, George Devine, quote, "I'm afraid I simply cannot accept omission or mediation of the prayer passage, which appears to me indispensable as it stands. I think this does call for a firm stand." And this is the Beckett that most people are familiar with, somebody who's really unwilling to water down or introduce any of his works for public consumption. And so it's in this light that the extent to which Beckett was willing to modify his own published work at the BBC's request is indeed most unusual. Just three examples from the BBC files stand out in this respect, although there are others. First, parts from the trilogy were aired on the third program in December 1957 from Molloy, which ran just under an hour, June 1958 from Malone Dies, which went fully 72 minutes, and in January 1959, another hour, this time on The Unnameable. Molloy, in the end, proved the least problematic, with the end of the first part excerpted almost in its entirety, while substantial cuts to The Unnameable were needed to give the work for radio a coherence that it may, indeed, intentionally not have had on the page. Yet that from Malone Dies is most revealing. So I hope I showed here. These are the cuts that were Beckett was suggesting to Donald McWhinney in a letter to Donald there typed out from Beckett. Beckett rejected parts of the initial... They wanted to do the first 23 pages, and Beckett rejected that on the idea that they included Sappho, and he says, "I don't like those passages." As you can see there, I don't like, the Sappho passages from my sequence one, I don't like them, and I think they're less suited to McGee than Malone's monologue proper. Yet as his exchange with Donald McWhinney in early 1958 makes clear, he was persuaded to include Sappho at the behest of his collaborators, including McGee, who's mentioned up there, and his cousin John Beckett, the latter responsible for the score for all three of the works in the trilogy. Quote, "I wanted to keep Sappho out of the Malone reading," Beckett wrote to Barney Rossett on the 10th of March, 1956. Quote, "But McWhinney, John, and McGee all want him in, so I let him in." Out, on the other hand, Klaus Ziliakis notes, quote, "with one or two Molloy passages deemed not presentable in public." And you probably figure which ones those are from the last 16 pages. I think it's the anus is the zone of being. Really not going to make it into the BBC of the 1950s. Excised were three cuts in the body of the text from Malone Dies, and this is my key point, unbeknownst to Beckett beforehand. There's McWhinney just saying, "I'm sorry, we had to make some additional cuts." It is hard to imagine Beckett accepting this from anyone other than McWhinney at the time. As with the late 1950s rendering of the trilogy, so too with Godot, first broadcast on the 27th of April 1960, produced by McWhinney for a six-part cast that included McGee as Vladimir, Wilfred Bramble as Echegon, Donnelly as Lucky, Felix Felton as Potso, Jeremy Ward as a boy, and far and away, most unexpectedly, Dennis Hawthorne as narrator. The latter surprise led Klaus Ziliakis to conclude, quote, "In a 1971 letter to me, Beckett writes that he must have known about and authorized this version of spoken stage directions, but that he would not consent to it today." As the script makes clear, these were not just stage directions, but included several cuts to the text as published, as well as some quite intrusive interventions. For example, when Lucky is ordered to think, at the end of Act 1, one narrative line simply states, ironically enough, quote-unquote, "silence." That's the only way you can get it across on the radio. Finally, given the textual minutiae powering genetic criticism, which, generically speaking, analyzes manuscript iterations, sources, and variants, and tracing out the writing process between draft and publication. Does that sound all right? That'll do. Even a one-word change can merit a mention. And here's just one. Sorry, that's what I'm looking for there. For instance, only 5 years after writing to Ziliakis about Godot's surprise narrator and offering Martin Eslin the long-dormant Rough for Radio 2 in January 1976, Beckett was persuaded to consider changing animator to operator at the BBC's request. And there you can see he's talking about sketch for radio or rough for radio there. And so kind of even allowing them to have a say, perhaps, in the titling of the work. Still more revealingly, in the 1982 Halloween broadcast of Ill Seen, Ill Said, first published only a year before, the producer Ronald Mason cut the text's very first word, the preposition from, thus changing the opening sentence from, quote, from where she lies, she sees Venus rise, to where she lies, she sees Venus rise. Considering the burgeoning interest in this empirical area of Beckett studies, which I dare say I have to declare a special interest, the variations between text or drama on the one hand and the BBC's radio production as broadcast on the other are equally fascinating and quite potentially fruitful for scholarship. Simply put, Beckett's willingness to alter his work for BBC Radio was a rare thing indeed. And with respect to otherwise refused adaptations of his work, Beckett was far more flexible with the BBC than most anyone else, as indicated in a letter from the BBC's copyright department to Curtis Brown regarding the radio version of Play, which was later broadcast on the 11th of October 1966 by the Third Program. Dated 26th of February that year, this opens... you will remember refusing us permission last November to broadcast Play because Mr. Beckett did not wish his stage works to be performed in any other medium. Now it seems someone has been at work and managed to persuade Mr. Beckett to change his mind, or at any rate to the extent of giving us permission in principle to broadcast Play at an appropriate length of 30 minutes. Now you can see just the sort of a knockback on what would have been a fantastic production of three dialogues. There, Mr. Beckett doesn't wish this reading to be given. So, that's the first of the three themes I'm going to touch upon. The second is collaboration and creativity. Now, throughout his career, as is very well known, Beckett went to the wall for his friends, whether in reviewing their work, as illustrated by earlier text in Disjecta on McGreevy, the Van Veldas, and Jack B. Yeats, or in collaboration with others for translations. There were, of course, exchanges like the 1949 Three Dialogues, and many others besides, whether Giacometti's famous tree for the opening Godot, or in dedicating works to help friends, such as with Barney Rossett and his dedication of 1988's Stirring Still. Sorry, Beckett dedicated that to Barney Rossett to help him out of a bind. Is that right? To help him out of a bind and set up his new... Regarding Beckett and music, for example, Mary Bryden's collection with that title, Samuel Beckett and Music, from 1998, contains chapters covering collaborative work with the composer Marcel Mihailovici, who provided the radio score for Cascando, as well as Morton Feldman on both the 1976 prose poem Neither, and later Words and Music for the Beckett Festival of Radio, Beckett Festival of Radio Plays in Dublin during April 1989. Similarly, his regard for actors like Jack McGowan, Ronald Pickup, and the aforementioned Patrick McGee, as well as several others, meant that they were invariably cast in BBC productions of Beckett's works, sometimes even as a condition for broadcasting rights. And so in addition to his trust in these actors faithfully rendering his art, moreover, it is a safe bet that his very close relationships with the BBC, with Barbara Bray, with Martin Eslin, and Donald McWhinney above all, were a driving force in the extent of, in the comparative flexibility towards, and on the frequent participation in adaptations of his work from the mid-1950s on. Now, of course, this high regard cut both ways, which also has its traceable effects. A relevant example is the BBC's first broadcast of Molloy and the previously unpublished From an Abandoned Work, both of which were read by McGee on the 10th and 14th of December 1957, respectively. On these days, Beckett's BBC reception in Paris was poor, and he requested copies, the actual audio copies, reel-to-reel from McWhinney 2 days before Christmas 1957. In addition to informing him that, unfortunately, the lines Vero, Vero had been cut, again, unbeknownst to Beckett, in From an Abandoned Work, McWhinney responded on New Year's Eve 1957 by admitting, quote, it may be difficult to arrange records for him to audit in Paris. The long and short of that story is the BBC were like, we don't care if it's Beckett, we don't care who it is, we're not letting any of our soundboard tapes go out of sight. Yet after extensive internal discussion, some strings were nonetheless pulled at the BBC, and he was able to listen to the recorded broadcast in the BBC's Paris office with its Parisian representative, Cecilia Reeves, in early 1958. In turn, this tape session was apparently enough to spark Beckett's inspiration. During the month that the BBC dithered over whether to allow him a personal copy of Molloy from an abandoned work, he started and finished Krapp's last tape, of course, memorably using a tape recorder as a central prop. And there he says, I just had an idea. I want to put it on to you. I've written a short stage monologue for McGee, definitely non-radio, involves a tape recorder. In terms of technology, critics like Hugh Kenner, Jonathan Bicknell, and Yoshiki Tajiri have written compellingly on Beckett's long-standing interest in technology, whether radio, tape recorders, or later his engagement with television and film, including the dozen BBC productions of Beckett's work in his many years from 1961. And here's just a short list, some of the ones that they put on film. Waiting for Godot, you can see there, A. Joe, and a few other shades. Beckett's television work with the BBC is also covered in some detail in his BBC Written Archives files, and although the focus I want to give here is upon Anglophone radio, records on TV in French, Spanish, and other language broadcasts likewise merit scholarly attention. But in terms of radio, two final examples, again from amongst many, of creative collaboration underscores what I take to be the centrality of this medium for Beckett, and the third program's key role in facilitating it. As I noted earlier, the new head of Drama Sound by early 1976, Martin Esslin, was able to secure this sketch for radio or rough for radio for the third program for Beckett's 70th birthday. In the intervening months, they exchanged revealing letters about the recording, extending to decisions on silence, sound effects, and even the suggestion of a concluding, quote, faint sob from the stenographer that sheds revealing light upon the play. And there you can see the sort of discussion that they had, and this is from Beckett answering his queries on rough for radio. Swish without impact, swish with impact. He says, at the end, if you like, faint song from stenographer. Again, this play was written during the period of Beckett's most intense collaboration with the BBC in the late 1950s and early 1960s, so it's perhaps fitting that this short work's resurrection was undertaken for Beckett's birthday by Radio 3, the sort of successor to the third program from 1967. But for yet another, still earlier anniversary, in this case the BBC's own 40th anniversary in 1962, these themes of friendship, collaboration, and technology were all in evidence for the lavish production of Words and Music. It had been finished almost a year earlier, as you can see in the sort of covering letter Beckett writes, with him submitting the script to Martin Esslin on 9th of December 61, and a covering note declaring that it was written for the BBC and John Beckett. I hear from him today that he would like to take it on. I hope it may be acceptable to the BBC also. They're like, please, we'll tear your hand off for it. Indeed, as the BBC says, quote, this was supposed to be our prestige production in the 40th anniversary week. And as Esslin pointed out on the 4th of September 1962, notwithstanding the serious challenges the production of Words and Music presented, quote, this is an extremely difficult operation as the play, which is not 15 minutes but 30 minutes duration, is one of the most intricate mergers of sound and music we have ever undertaken. Amongst others involved in this taxing enterprise, John Beckett's role was crucial as a composer, just as it had been for the three broadcasts of the trilogy over the late 50s. With influential artists like John Beckett, or again, Harold Pinter, who acted in several radio works for the BBC, including one of six voices for the 1971 Lessness, and the role of animator in the aforementioned Rough for Radio 2, 5 years later, there's clearly a great deal more work to be done in terms of Beckett's radio collaborations, indeed perhaps Beckett's collaborations more generally. Unlike the process of writing, of course, even the most straightforward radio production, say the reading of Beckett's poems on the third program over two parts in March and November 1966, there would invariably be questions of the BBC's framing, of musical accompaniment, of actors' voices, length, and often the selection of texts, all of which, naturally enough, was far from solitary work. When it came to radio, to some degree at least, negotiation and even concession were periodically necessary for Beckett. But by whom, exactly? And that takes me on to arguably a drier third theme, contracts and money, but it's been spiced up a little bit by a debate in Beckett Studies I'll refer to. One might be forgiven for considering contracts and money to be a dry subject, but in Beckett Studies it's been far less so than for other canonical modernists. I'm thinking the last several years, it's especially been the case since the 2011 publication of Stephen Dilks's Samuel Beckett in the Literary Marketplace, which in a review by Sean Kennedy, quote, seeks to deprive us of our received understanding of Beckett as a writer who is both indifferent to fame and uninterested in money. For Dilks, this has led to what he calls a hagiographic myth in Beckett Studies, cultivated by like a conspiracy of photographers, agents, publishers, critics, and even Beckett's estate, allegedly to the extent of overshadowing, I love this phrase, this is Dilks's phrase, Beckett salivating over his royalty statements. Just can't see it. My new royalty statement. In an article from that same year, Mark Nixon paints a very different picture with, quote, nearly half of Beckett's gray canon of drafts and manuscripts donated by Beckett himself either to institutions or to friends, in addition to actively supporting scholarship in his work. So there you get two sort of very different pictures, one of Beckett sort of greedily rubbing his hands, and another one of Beckett sort of giving it all away, doing what he can to help friends. They're very different poles. Really, my sole interest here is to suggest that Beckett's financial transactions held at Caversham tell something of a more nuanced story. One example is provided by the above-cited 30-minute production of Words and Music, which cost the third program in 1962 about £7,500 in today's currency. This included Beckett's copyright permission, which cost 75 guineas, on top of another £308.19 for the, quote, approximate cost of music. And so that's just the music cost there, as you can see. I think there were several pieces that were done by John Beckett. As this suggests, the BBC had pretty inflexible financial regulations in place. They would often pay by line or by minute. And rights were usually negotiated between their copyright department and not Beckett himself, of course, but Beckett's representatives. For Beckett's poetry, for instance, rights were held by an amenable John Calder, as evidenced by the two programs of poetry aired in March and November 1966, with payment agreed by line. And John Calder's like, yeah, that's fine, that's cool. The agency Curtis Brown handled Beckett's dramatic rights for television, where the BBC's appropriate fee was £3 per minute that same year. Sometimes a straight television fee was negotiated instead, as with £50 for the short Act Without Words 2, which had been agreed in September 1965. But on occasion, as really shouldn't be too surprising, Curtis Brown and other agents, not Beckett himself at least, in extant BBC records, drove a rather harder bargain. That same year, for example, Margaret McLaren balked at the BBC's offer of television rights for Hey Joe. Hey Joe. And this is my favorite of all of the quotes here I'm going to put to you. I certainly can't put to him your offer of £125. To get a television play from Sam is a miracle in itself. He has been asked for some years to write for television and always refused until he himself felt like he would like to do it. Surely the BBC can do better than this for one of the greatest playwrights of our time. She's really sort of pushing it. So she requested 600 quid. I won't take a penny less, but in the event agreed to twice the BBC's original offer at 250 quid. Finally, it appears that following his award of the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1969, the BBC paid an extra sixth over and above what it called the usual scale for use of Beckett's work. By the later 1970s, rights for some of his dramatic pieces were handled by a hard-nosed Sue Freethy from the London-based Spokesman Agency. So on the 9th of August 1978, she requested a compensation fee for the misuse of Beckett's work following unauthorized broadcast excerpts from Waiting for Godot. For this is, quote, something Mr. Beckett dislikes intensely and will only authorize for particular occasions at the request of personal friends. Clearly, BBC Cymru was not one of those friends. because 4 months later, rather than accept the... they were charged £15 additional, there it is, £15 compensation for this misuse of Mr. Beckett's work, which prompted a sort of ticking off internally in the BBC to say, we have to make sure that all of our quotations have copyright clearance. Then 4 months later, rather than accept the then £13 per minute Writers Guild rates for a new production, Sue Freethy pointed out that, quote, Samuel Beckett was very special. On the 13th of December 1979, she thus requested a flat fee of £1,000 for permission to broadcast all that fall, which rather seems to have terminated the discussions. That's the last letter. I don't even think they bothered to respond. At the very least, it seems, if Beckett was relatively untroubled by money in the last decades of his life, there was nevertheless, as we've seen already, a Beckett industry that had long blossomed by his 1969 Nobel laureateship. For those on the inside, this typically meant unselfish promotion of Beckett's work, with money seemingly a peripheral consideration for friends and close colleagues. But as may be expected of human nature, this is not always the case, and Stephen Dilks does have a point, if a highly, in my view, highly overstated one. You know, as Les Beckett greedily salivating over these royalty checks than others around him, and in the case of agents running a capitalist business, quite understandably so, who sometimes push the envelope financially in terms of these fees and payments from the BBC. And so now, really just in conclusion, the question must be asked, so what? What I've advanced so far may be said perhaps to have little bearing on Samuel Beckett, the writer, let alone our interpretation of him today. So let me return in conclusion to this wider lens by offering a few closing observations on the potential impact of this material on Beckett's studies. Through this cache of neglected materials at Caversham, we've seen Beckett's willingness to adopt his work for the third program in really quite startling ways, and observed an extensive collaboration with BBC actors, producers, and managers in doing so. In a metonymy of Beckett's inspiration with the tape recorder for Crap's Last Tape, surely all of this had a wider influence on his later poetics. Take the experimental novel Comment C'est, originally written and translated into English as How It Is, both at the height of Beckett's BBC work in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. Might it be possible to read this sonorous, unpunctuated, 160-plus page narrative as a kind of radiogenic text? Relevantly, just at this point, in fact only 4 months after the BBC's premiere of All That Fall in 1957, Beckett described his oeuvre as, quote, a matter of fundamental sounds. And that was to his American producer. I'm guessing many of you will have come across that line from 1957. Theorizing this phrase, matter of fundamental sounds, has long interested critics, particularly regarding Beckett's prose from this period on, which several scholars have discerned as rhythmic or spectral, such as the, quote, intricate oral patternings of the brief late poems, which in Stephen Matthews' view are, quote, where the late style of Beckett is most clearly revealed. And as for prose, so too for Beckett's plays, which Eric Tunning's study from 2007 understands as Samuel Beckett's abstract drama. Following shortly on the heels of How It Is, the 1962 one-act play, drama play, initiates what Tunning calls, quote, an aesthetic of abstraction, meaning that, quote, what we see and hear involves a fundamentally new kind of formal achievement, one that again underlines the transition in this play to an abstract dramatic style. Simply put, how much of this late style, either dramatic or textual, in this sort of late breakthrough, is owed to Beckett's immersion in radio from 1957 onwards? Still another area of long-standing interest remains Beckett's reception, both domestic, and I use that word in inverted commas because that he's been claimed domestically in France, Ireland, and even Britain, as well as internationally. Overwhelmingly, these works have emphasized the literary and dramatic reception of Beckett's art. Accordingly, much space is given over to literary scholars, drama critics, philosophers, and other public intellectuals in forming what Shane Weller has termed, I think very aptly, a broadly philosophical reading of Beckett's work in its first phase of international reception. Granted, that's true, but that was rarely how it was seen at the time by non-specialists. In fact, in Britain at least, it is quite likely that many more people heard Beckett on the radio than ever read his text or saw his plays, at the very least in the 1950s and 1960s, before he received the 1969 Nobel Prize. And for the most part, these everyday voices have been marginalized. I say for the most part, since the last thematic element that I'm going to close with from these Caversham manuscripts deserves special attention in closing here. And this is these very rare audience reports, this one taken from New Comment, and I'll say a word about that in a moment. First quote, beyond showing that radio mediated the reception of Beckett's art far more than previously acknowledged, these BBC audience reports also bear out a view long ago advanced by the theatre critic Vivian Mercier. It's one of my... It just speaks to the heart of Beckett and maybe the difficulty of interpretation, I think, very clearly. After attending an academic session, Mercier reported on, quote, a member of the audience who asked the panel the rhetorical question, isn't Waiting for Godot a sort of living Rorschach test? He was clapped and cheered by most of those present who clearly felt, as I still do, that most interpretations of that play, indeed of Samuel Beckett's work as a whole, reveal more about the psyches of the people who offer them than about the work itself or the psyche of its author. So keeping that in mind, in addition to the three themes we've already sketched above, collectively, as we've seen, revealing a flexibility, a willingness to negotiate, and collaborative effort quite at odds with traditional views of Beckett, this final issue of audience reception, I think, is perhaps the most revealing. For these were everyday British voices reacting to what was coming over their radio sets. And so this new comment that I had mentioned before from the 11th of October program dedicated to Beckett's work received an A or an A-plus from 7% of the audience that had been surveyed, from 46% of the 61 questionnaires returned to the BBC, with only 25% rating it a C, or giving it as lowest mark, 5%, a C-. Nonetheless, the BBC realized that its overall audience appreciation index came in at a number, because that's what the BBC does. They crunch all this down. They say, here's your number. It was well below the average of 61, coming in at 56. And indeed, some of the criticism of Beckett criticism regarding that new comment piece was quite fierce. A farmer heard people trying to make something profound and eternal out of his plays. A retired art mistress found merely proof of decadence in literature. While a teacher thought that in keeping with other avant-gardists, Beckett's work and its supposed elucidation was meaningless to normal people. And now, final two slides. An earlier audience survey, the only one that we have on Beckett's work itself, this is from Malloy and from Abandoned Work, likewise found opinions, quote, sharply divided over Beckett's Malloy and from an Abandoned Work. Both broadcast, as I mentioned, in mid-December 1957. From Malloy, responses were advanced by a writer who found the work meaningless, a research worker, poor, a retired colonial administrator, an insurance clerk, a flight lieutenant, a physicist, two clerks, a secretary, so you get the opinion, and a commercial artist, the latter concluding, quote, I'm sorry I can't be more lucid, it's not so much what Mr. Beckett has to say as the way he says it, which so grips one. Then as now, it was the force of Beckett's work which grabbed the attention of Britons from all walks of life, including those who absolutely hated it. For many, although we've largely forgotten this today, this was an experience enhanced, indeed facilitated by the third program's unapologetically Arnoldian content. Fortunately for us, the BBC doused its listeners in Beckett, contributing to both his continuing experiments at the limits of artistic expression, no less than attendant public perceptions, and thereby, if only indirectly, our ongoing reception and interpretation of those fundamental sounds. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. That was fascinating. It's lovely to see the documents themselves as opposed to PowerPoint transcripts. Imagine all more vividly the secretaries of the BBC compiling these surveys and saying,
I have to type up another
56.
Not appreciation, 52.
Try harder next time. Mm-hmm. Yes, quite what that means Imagine doing it.
Not bad enough to get them to stop doing Beckett, clearly. No. So, yes, that's something. But yeah, unfortunately, these are the only ones that we have of Beckett's actual work.
Yeah.
And they really do have some, you know, some quite long. They see the administrator, the insurance clerk. It's amazing stuff, actually.
Other questions and comments on Matthew's paper? If I can start off then, when I was looking through this material, and covered a lot of the same ground, the question that was that was pressing for me was, as well as the few that you pointed out, an issue of genre explicitly, and you separated out the radiophonic works from the non-radiophonic works, the adaptations. But when I was reading through, I found that a useful division was between the more conventional drama and prose. Mm-hmm. It seemed like Beckett objected whenever the phrase performance or dramatisation was used, whereas reading always good. If someone proposed a reading, then put the check in the post and we'll get going. In fact, that Three Dialogues was the only exception I found to this.
Really? Interesting.
And I wondered whether you had anything to say to that division, to the drama against...
I take your point. And of course, drama and prose have long been the kind of division in Beckett's studies anyway, between people kind of working on one or the other. Even the most straightforward minimalistic reading, and I think we have to go back and actually get these again, but I think that you're still going to get some framing. I think you're still going to get potentially musical accompaniment, some excerpting. So to me, that I stand by the idea of adaptations and separate them out from radiogenic work, but I think you've got a very good point on why Beckett sort of got his back up with the idea that it was a performance, and that might have allowed for kind of changes to the work that he couldn't have foreseen. Whereas presumably a lot of the scripts that have been going around, Beckett would have himself sent off, or for the most part, he would have agreed. Now again, there are these kind of several cuts that Beckett didn't know about, and the thing that didn't make it into this paper that was more surprising than all of the cuts was the unnameable, where basically he says, look, I trust you, he says to Barbara and Donald McWhinney, I trust you, excerpt whatever you want. And I haven't come across any example of that. Mm-hmm. I think we still need to learn more. Who chose, for example, the poems? And there were three readings of his poetry. Mm-hmm. So I take your point, unless we're really talking about putting all prose, including the poetry, on one side and then the drama, which really some of the work on the drama is very surprising that he accepted play being done on the radio, for example, or for that matter, the BBC doing Endgame, or the French version of Endgame, entirely in French in 1957. Mm-hmm. Kind of unashamedly highbrow. And I think that's one of the reasons that Beckett seems to have been more willing, even with performances, to have been willing to let his work appear with the BBC. I really do think that some of it has to do with prestige, but a lot of it, whether Beckett realized this or not, we see on here where they're talking about these broadcasts being 0.1% of the adult population of the United Kingdom. And obviously they would go, I shouldn't say obviously, but they would go out and they would oftentimes be rebroadcast. So probably on average these things were done twice. Well, that's 100,000 potential listeners at this time. And I think
I was going to ask about that, because that when you pointed out that what was the first thing that was broadcast and it was only available in that run from the Olympia Press and Berlin Press. Very soon after that was broadcast, then there are letters in the published letters requesting permission to publish what and any more works like this. So there was clearly a commercial interest there that, if it wasn't the motivation, then it was certainly an added benefit.
And you're absolutely spot on, because I think it had been suggested just as the opening run of Godot in London had gone on. So the idea is, this is now kind of Beckett in London, let's get him for his hot new French property, let's get him over here and do something. And I can't help but feel that those things were tied in. We just don't know enough about Margaret Ramsay's role,
Or that, I mean, really, until the second edition of the letters came out, we didn't even know that Watt had actually gone out, or that they had been paid for it. So I expect that the next version of letters, which comes out, I think, in several months, at a guess, I think a huge amount is going to be dealing with radio. And I think it would probably bear out your point even more. It's the
all this is being read by an announcer as opposed to an actor.
Yes, and you made that point that he's... you know, sort of, and again, the voices are themselves different. We can expect that would be RP rather than, you know, the Irish voice you might associate with Watt. Yeah. So there's, you know, some questions about the voice that I'm still very keen to recover. Yes.
Have you heard recordings of Holmstrom's voice?
No, I haven't, no.
You can listen online.
Is that right?
It's a very famous sort of Lincoln. He has to do this tremendous filler when a live broadcast concert goes awry and they can't get the piano hoisted onto the stage properly, and he gives this sort of test match special-esque commentary of, oh, they're trying to lift it up by hand now, and everybody's looking slightly uncomfortable, the audience is sitting in their seats, and he fills and fills and fills, and this is the guy that read the
The six pages about the lynches, right? That's a great point, and I think that you're probably right about the difference between performance and reading. Although, at least in the early years, I think it's astounding how Beckett pretty much, to our knowledge, said yes to everything.
So can I ask a question about form and the impact on form of radio? Because it looks like a third type of medium. He's already been practicing prose, and he's had kind of third-person prose and first-person prose, and then he's produced some plays, and then eventually, sort of after all of that, he produces some radio. Is that right? Is that
and then
roughly
TV.
Speaking?
Yeah.
And then a bit of TV. And then there's the late style, as it were. And one of your questions was, is there an impact on the late style of radio? So might the impact be, and I have no idea, and it's sort of a question for Beckettians, is something to do with, as banal in a way, as point of view, or
you're absolutely right.
Or the, I mean, so the three novels, they have somebody writing, don't they? They have somebody actually describing.
Although a lot of that is what's cut out, I think. You know, I have the excisions, but it's more straightforward in the three novels. But
in the three novels, it's somebody saying, I'm writing this, they bring me paper, I write stuff. So it's a sort of written thing. But in the late poetry, it's much more disembodied from the it's text, but it's detextualized. And I'm just wondering if that might be what radio does, because it accentuates voice without body. So
absolutely.
Sort of between drama and prose, but it draws back from the context of somebody actually writing, so that it can be a more pure voice, a more pure sort of monologue. So I kind of associate that with the late style, those sorts of
disembodied spectral.
Yeah, exactly. But it means that the act of writing has been erased from the later stuff as well.
Very
present in the I don't know, it might be an obvious point for the Beckettians, but
that's a good one to open up to other people. Maybe with the question, this is, I've really been thinking about this because I think this is the key thing. If the late work sometimes doesn't have pronouns, it's not he, it's not I, it's not you.
Yeah.
Is who's speaking? Obviously, well, I shouldn't say obviously, the idea is that Beckett writes it, it's a text that's published, that then gets produced by the BBC, and then spoken by Jack Holmstrom or something, someone else. It's not really first, second, or third person anyway. It's almost like a fourth person disembodied voice. We really don't know who's speaking, and that, of course, is a core of Beckett's late works. I absolutely agree with you on the kind of moving past the act of writing. Does anybody who's kind of looked at Beckett have a view? Sorry.
I think that it's really difficult to say, and it has to be in part speculation that chronology is right. But then I don't think that the content of the radio plays themselves bears out that narrative, in the sense that you don't have a kind of progression of that increasingly disembodied voice that goes through the trilogy suddenly appearing without physical form on a page. Through the radio, they're multi-character things, mostly.
What you do get in the radio, though, which is interesting, is in the same way that in the prose you often get somebody writing something. In the radio works, you often get somebody calling up sounds, whether it's I'm thinking of embers and the calling for hooves, or rough for radio too, where there's a kind of extraction of speech from a body that's implied there, words and music, that you almost get a version of the act of, I don't know whether it's listening to or producing radio, but some kind of radiophonic exchange.
Mm. Yeah, the sounds are wrenched from the musical instruments. And
yes.
I think we'd be wrong to say it's like one thing and then another. I mean, certainly there's bits of writing and the act of writing even late, but I still think that Finn's right that at the beginning, we are talking about writing in a hand. In this, let's call it middle period, it seems to me it's more about the voice or about, and then even the late Beckett, where he is doing TV stuff, I think it's more about the eyes and the view and the vision. Now, it's not that one stops and he goes, I'm never doing that again, but it's hard for me not to let's put it in a negative. Doing 24 adaptations or works for the BBC, whatever one, had no influence on politics whatsoever. That I don't find tenable.
Mm.
It might have been a minor thing, it might not be huge, it might not be decisive in any way, but I don't think it can have no effect on his poetics. So the question is what it is, and to kind of hammer down, you know, what that question is. I tend to agree with you that voice or the disembodied voice. Think of Company. A voice comes to one on his back in the dark. Imagine. I mean, that's almost like the start of a great radio play.
Yeah, but then you have Daniel Albright arguing that the tin openers shoved into someone else's body and how it is someone tuning and detuning a radio. I'm not saying that follows on to anything that we're talking about here, but
that's a little bit too literalist.
It is too literalist, and that would be my criticism of it. But there are other ways of. I just wanted to put it out there as another way, other than thinking about disembodied voices.
You can fetishise the medium, can't you?
Right.
That would be an example of that in criticism and sort of focus on.
And
on
I think
technology sometimes does that.
Yeah.
And that line, my work is a matter of fundamental sounds. That's a very interesting line, but I think we can take that to read Beckett felt that way at all times about his work, and that'd be overinterpreting.
Well, I wonder if one way of trying to address this question of how radio informs the late style is not only thinking in terms of the form, but also because you have these ways of tracing through the BBC archives how it was that he started writing for radio, are there any ways in which one might trace why he stopped?
That's a great question. I absolutely don't. And he stops alongside, he moves into the translation of La Manivelle. We have these abortive texts, the Rough for Radio 1, Rough for Radio 2. Maybe, he felt like he kind of shot his bolt. The other thing that I had to give some short shrift to is I do think that radio helped pull him out of this kind of despair, this despondency. There's lots more evidence that he was down at the time. Maybe he didn't need it in the same way that, to help him in this, new creative. I tend to agree with critics who find that Beckett from the early 60s on, I'm thinking of Play and How It Is, that really starts late Beckett. That is a big change in his poetics. And I think that some of that, to get that moving, was turning his mind to this. He was so down about translating the unnameable.
And collaborating with people.
Yeah, I think that, and there's probably less of that collaboration after this really intense period. I think answering that question would probably shed a lot of light on why he did it in the first place, and why he carried on giving them works. Maybe he was just saying yes, or his agents were saying it's a lot of money. I mean, we've only scratched the surface of this stuff.
It's also interesting to speculate to what extent he was sort of simply following BBC policy, and this is certainly how I've thought about it in those radiophonic works, that clearly adaptation, reading pieces of prose and drama, was the norm for the BBC. 99% of things that they broadcast were like that. And it was only with the development of some kind of specific radiophonic policy in the BBC that Beckett was one of the people who, it was a confluence of requirements. He needed a new change, a new way of doing things, and they needed somebody prestigious to make the radio seem better than the TV.
And in fact, McWhinney was hired for that very, let's do something new, let's do something different. And in fact, the thing that maybe you know, doesn't stomp it but closes it down, is, you know, the Words of Music that was done in 62, the last of these big productions, is the BBC's like flagship 40th anniversary project. Maybe they didn't come knocking after that. Mm. You know, they certainly were happy, or apparently happy, with how it came out. But it's entirely possible they're like, okay, we've done enough new Beckett for a while. We're getting audience ratings that are plummeting or something like that.
This stuff about the bull's prison is fascinating. It's hilarious.
Well, amazing.
It shouldn't be hilarious because Beckett says it's some not only comic value in disproportion between violence and blow and weakness of reaction. Because that's a kind of negotiation, isn't it? But Beckett's coming back to his own poetic and being quite absolute about it, so he's not. Particular angles that.
No, but this idea of the faint song from Stenographer, I mean, we see that also in Not I, where you have somebody who's kind of darkened and off stage, who's kind of there, which gives you a not alone kind of thing. So, again, it's interesting how he's willing. You're right, in some cases, he's not going to rewrite the whole thing for the BBC, but he's willing to make concessions that I don't see him making in other media and in other relationships, certainly not after Godot.
But he's always having to do that with theatre a bit, though, isn't he? I mean, he can't shape the prosody of every single line of his actors.
Well, there's a bit of a debate, I think, about this that goes on amongst the drama bods that say that it was totally different when he was there, whether he's directing or not. He really could be quite, you know, you're going to do it this way. Mm. And apparently, the productions were better when he wasn't there and allowed people a little bit more chance to breathe. Is that kind of fair to say, is that he could, or at least actors felt that he could sometimes be a bit overbearing and overweening in terms of doing this way.
Yeah, some did, but some thought he was great. I mean,
what he was better. But I mean, I know that there were some cases where it really reduced people to tears. I can't do this. And there was a sense, there was one moment where they kind of said, Sam, don't turn up for this, actually, but we're fine without you.
I don't doubt it was the case at some point, but it's gone.
Other questions?
What you're saying about the third programme is very interesting, in the way they had not writers like David Jones, of course. And I was interested. Did you? And this is just talking about your other area of interest. But did you know that rate the third programme broadcast Ezra Pound's operas?
Yes, in the early 30s.
Yeah, that was in the early 30s. Yes. So I was just interested in. There's a general policy there, isn't there, of putting out these new experimental things.
Yeah, and he was commissioned to write them. And what's funny is I got the, because I was like, oh, maybe there's some story behind this. Mm. And Beck was in touch with the then controller, a guy named EAF Harding. Mm. And they're corresponding between 31 and 33, which is a period I'm very interested in because of his turn to fascism. Mm. And he starts sort of hitting up EAF Harding with, but did you know that there's an economic conspiracy going on? And Harding's just kind of like, lose my address. I'm not writing to you anymore. So I think that's kind of what killed it, is the fact it was kind of like, do you know that you're on the side of Satan?
You know, I've never heard of that spokesman agency before. It was Curtis Brown before, and Curtis Brown after. So I just imagine this Sue hearing things on the radio, just writing things in and asking for increasingly more money, and there's no such agency. And eventually...
She just came in on the street.
She goes up to that £1,000, and that would explain why the communication stops, I suppose. But I don't expect that's the case.
Yeah, sort of cash.
Is it strange that it should go back and forward to and from Curtis Brown, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think he had different agents and representatives for different. So somebody had, you know, obviously the drama and the prose, but I also think there were American rights and British rights and things like that. And it got a little bit more complicated when it was these first publication of things. So Kohler was fine with it. The Unnameable, again, was heard before it had actually been available and written, which to me is quite significant, quite potentially important. But Colmer's like, yeah, fine, no problem. Whereas I think with some of the other agents, they really are trying to get their money out that way.
But Spokesman wouldn't have been for the States, would they? Because that would have been...
I'll double check again. I've got the...
details of them in another thing, but I think that they were British based, unless I'm mistaken.
Which would mean it should have been Curtis Brown. But
it might have been for Drawn?
What Curtis Brown?
Curtis Brown would be Drawn.
Maybe they were before Rosic Colander, and that was for prose.
No, well, they're asking for. Telling them off for Gardel, but yeah, it's.
But it's not. It's nothing to do with requesting. It's enforcing, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah,
it's Rosic Colander.
Close to change or something, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm.
Did a bit of a cult of Beckett develop in the BBC? Is that another part of what
I think
you find? I mean, it's
definitely had its champions, yeah, in the early period. And the way in which they, you know, this is a whole other area that we could discuss, but the way in which they frame him is very, I mean, Martin Esslin is famous for that phrase, theater of the absurd. That's his phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And he really casts Beckett in really existential terms.
Mm-hmm.
So they did the whole of the Text for Nothing in four parts, and it's kind of an exploration of being. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but it's very, you know, very existential, very Martin Esslin-esque. So they get in there first and are able to kind of frame the way in which it's going to be done. And I find that fascinating as well, because almost certainly Esslin and McWhinney are the ones writing the program notes, and it seems like most of the time they're not pushing them past Beckett.
I wonder if Reith has any kind of presence in any of these negotiations, because He may be pro a bit of experimental culture, but he's quite uptight, isn't he? So, I mean, some of that earlier censorship stuff might have some connection to him. I'm just wondering what his view might be, because he might be part of a bunch of people who thought that existential experiments was a bit cleaner than pre-war modernist experiment, where we came down quite heavily against Lawrence and Joyce on the radio. So Beckett might appear like a cleaner form of modernism, which might not be true,
sure.
but might be being wrapped up as that through the existential.
Well, it's Eric's argument, Eric Tunning's argument, that the sort of the more more kind of avant-garde people at the BBC responded to what he calls Christian modernists, and whether or not one agrees with that entirely. The way in which they framed Beckett in The Listener is really interesting. So 4 days before All That Fall comes out, which is itself a line from the Bible, of course, All That Fall, they run in The Listener a Christian interpretation of Waiting for Godot. And clearly that's intended to kind of, gin up interest for the new production that's happening at the end of the week. But the idea that at the very least they're commissioning stuff around, again, let's call it Christian modernism, makes sense, and that's where the David Jones comes in, and a lot of these guys, not that this necessarily proves anything one way or the other, a lot of them are kind of Welsh Catholics. There's like three or four really senior kind of Welsh Catholics, and they go for David Jones, and they go for the kind of the Christian view of Beckett, or it seems that way. So, you know, that's entirely possible that that's something that they're kind of, you know, they're keen to push forward.
Do we have any last questions? It's about time to close up, otherwise. Okay. Next week we have Rhys Tranter, who I suppose most of you will know as the blogger for A Piece of Monologue, which is an excellent website and covers lots of things, and Beckett very prominently. He had to change his title because I've been very proud that I've managed to remember that he was going to be talking about walking, and then he tells me that he's not. So the cruelty. But it'd be very nice to see you next week to listen to Rhys. But before then, if you'd like to join me in thanking Matthew again for the excellent talk.
Thank you.